Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that enables you to improve your mental health from anywhere at any time. Get matched with a licensed therapist from over 2,000 choices and message them whenever you need to. No commutes and no judgments. For a special offer for our listeners, visit Talkspace.com/freak and use the code FREQ to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show. Talkspace, it's therapy for how we live today.
Like, yeah. Get on board.
But that's the thing. This is the thing that irritates me, is that part of the argument is this didn't used to be offensive, but now the PC brigade
right.
is looking to be right. outraged. And I'm like, no, it was always fucked up.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 21. I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by my fellow food eaters, Carolyn Pettit.
Yum, yum, yum.
Uni Aster.
I can't. What?
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, where the feminist killjoy is coming for your media, depending on your perspective. On today's show, we're going to be talking about Netflix's new food travel show, Ugly Delicious, and a mobile game called Bury Me My Love about Syrian refugees. As always, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Exclusively for our fantastic drip backers, we'll be recording a bonus segment. This week, Carolyn's going to tell us her initial reactions on the video game Far Cry 5.
And boy, is it a video game.
Everything Feminist Frequency produces, including this very podcast, is listener, reader, and fan supported. Thank you for helping us stay on the air and on the web. If you want access to special perks and exclusive backer awards, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now on with the show.
All right. Hey, Anita.
Hey, Carol.
You went to see Chromeo this weekend.
I did.
Yeah.
How do you know that that's not my freak out and you're ruining it?
Oh, no. It's not. Because you know, you seemed a little lukewarm on the show.
Yeah.
I mean, I only know them from, like, Night by Night and stuff, which I think is, like, such an amazing song. But,
So I wasn't lukewarm. There's a thing where there's bands who are really good in studio and just, like, the... Chromeo is such a well-oiled machine that that while it's a fun show, there is a little bit of like, oh, I'm watching a machine work.
Yeah.
Right? So you lose a little bit of the energy.
I think of like Daft Punk and like where the most thrilling moments to me of like a Daft Punk live show are when, say, they take, you know, two like hit songs of theirs and fuse them together into something that's like incredibly new.
Yeah.
It's like familiar, but it's also so exciting because of the way those two songs come together.
And Chromeo does a little bit of that in their live show. I like how over the top and wacky they are.
Sure.
And I love that like their songs are, they're sexual without being sexist.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're just like almost a parody of themselves.
Yeah.
Like I'm so fascinated by this band. So
yeah,
it's a fun show. Like
sure.
I recommend it, but
cool.
It wasn't, you know, it didn't blow me away or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That was cool.
Yeah.
What's our pop culture news this week?
So we've talked previously on the cast about Hari Kondabolu's documentary, The Problem with Apu, which is this really great analysis of how Apu has sort of, the character of Apu on The Simpsons has, in significant and meaningful ways reinforced like harmful stereotypes and, you know, that a lot of brown kids like Hari himself when he was younger were, you know, taunted and teased and mocked through, you know, the stereotypes that Apu reinforced. And Hari wanted to start a conversation about that with his film. In last night's episode of The Simpsons, a brand new episode, there was a little gag, I guess you could say, of The Simpsons writers clearly sort of responding to the film. And so what happens in it is Marge is like frustrated about, you know, maybe something that she's liked in the past and is now considered like problematic. And she says to Lisa, like, well, what am I supposed to do? And Lisa says, it's hard to say. Something that started decades ago and was applauded and inoffensive is now politically incorrect. What can you do? And then she turns in to look at it. There's a portrait of Apu on her nightstand, and it says, don't have a cow, because he's Hindu, right? Don't have a cow. And Marge says, Marge and Lisa both look into the camera, and Marge is like, some things will be dealt with at a later date. And Lisa says, if at all. And so this is super fucked up and frustrating on, like, so many levels. So Hari tweeted a few things in response to this that I want to share as well. He said, in The Problem with Apu, I used Apu and The Simpsons as an entry point into a larger conversation about the representation of marginalized groups and why this is important. The Simpsons' response tonight is not a jab at me, but at what many of us consider progress. He also quote tweeted another person on Twitter. Their tweet read, I love when a bunch of Harvard white guys tell us what's racist. And Hari's response was, ding, ding, ding. The other thing that they call out as, like, really frustrating about this is that, you know, Lisa is kind of, like, the voice of, the closest thing on The Simpsons to, like, a voice of authority, or the smart one, the one whose, like, opinions and intellect we're supposed to respect. As, you know, if Homer says something, it's like, oh, it's Homer, he's an idiot, you know, he says wild shit all the time. But by having Lisa say this to the audience, it gives it even more, like, yeah, this is just politically, you know, this is just PC-ness run rampant. This is just bullshit. And so it's super frustrating to see The Simpsons, which, you know, at times has been, you know, kind of leaned into progressiveness a little bit here and there, to fall down so hard and unambiguously.
I mean, it would have been better if they just didn't say anything
at
all.
Of course,
like, that's so fucked up. And it feels like a lot of the you know, the comments that we've gotten recently from sort of old school creators of things who are just like, oh God, so PC police. Oh God, why does everyone care about representation stuff? Like, you know, and we keep hearing this, and it comes up around me too as well. We had talked about a little bit, and I'm like, times are changing.
Yeah.
Get on it. Like, get on board.
But that's the thing. This is the thing that irritates me, is that part of the argument is this didn't used to be offensive, but now the PC brigade is looking to be outraged. And I'm like, no, it was always fucked up. The problem, Dana Gould and the rest of the writing staff and producing staff of The Simpsons, is that you didn't have a brown guy like Hari Kondabolu with enough of a profile saying things with an audience that could then amplify the fact that people have been pissed off about this from the beginning. You know, so it's not as if, no, we just discovered that there was a problem with Apu. It's just now the voices who are saying, yo, that's fucked up, have been amplified. So y'all can kiss my entire black ass. Nope. Keep it.
The whole thing.
The whole thing. Line up and join a club. Take numbers. Kiss the entire ass.
Yeah, it's fucked up. Oh, boy. All right. Let's I have no transition. Here we go.
Yeah.
Let's talk about food.
Yeah.
While thinking about kissing Ebony's ass.
We can talk about that. Although it's interesting, like, Carl, you talked about the Harvard, like, you know, glad to hear a bunch of, like, Harvard white guys telling us what is and what isn't racist, right? So, like the 70-year-old that I am, I watched 60 Minutes last night. There was a segment that Oprah did about lynching and about the this piece
on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, well, dig this, right? So it's a segment with Oprah in conversation with civil rights attorney Brian Stevenson, who is amazing. And so in Alabama, in Montgomery, Alabama, there's this just heart-stopping, moving, really thoughtful, engaged, like, important memorial to the victims of lynching, right? So there's this segment on that in 60 Minutes. The very next segment is about the Harvard Lampoon. And it, like, the difference in tone is so fucking startling, right? Because you go to this room and it literally is just full of white people, right? Like, it's just so many young white people cracking themselves up with the dumbest ass jokes. I mean, like, I felt bad because it's children, right? You know, like, you got 19 and 20 year olds drinking their first beers in a room. Like, this is their first experience of a writer's room. But I was like, you know what? Maybe when you put the show together, don't sandwich the segment about lynching, about this, like, American wound with, and then end the show with, but the Harvard Lampoon and Conan O'Brien.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, that's so tone deaf.
It was fucked up. Yeah.
Well, speaking of white people and food. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, I mean, there is some of that.
There is some of that. So on my freak out last week, I talked about Ugly Delicious, and I somehow convinced my fellow food eaters.
Because you...
I don't know about food
you're
lovers.
You're the boss?
Food eaters. Nah. This is a democracy on the podcast, please.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You're like, oh, I somehow convinced. You told us to watch it. That's how it went down.
I lightly suggested when nobody had any other ideas that we talk about this show, which I, you know, is selfish because I fucking love food shows, especially like travel food shows and shit like that. So Ugly Delicious is Netflix's newest food show starring David Chang, who... is an award-winning chef, has a million restaurants. He's the owner of Momofuku. And a lot of people are comparing him to, like, in this show in particular, to, like, the new Anthony Bourdain or, like, the younger, you know, Anthony Bourdain in terms of, like, starting to build this career as, you know, he's already been known as a celebrity chef in some ways. But, like, this show, I think, really cemented the... go out into the world and talk about food.
The, like,
and
professional food appreciator.
And
helping people understand. Yeah.
Like, not working in the kitchen as much, more of, like, the business, like, personality kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I really liked the show. I had you watch, I suggested, because I don't think you two watched all of it, I suggested particular episodes
suggested.
That I thought would be. Oh my God. Whatever.
I want to emphasize to people what a dictator you are. I just want to make that clear week on week that I'm being persecuted by being forced to watch TV for my job.
It went something like, we're not going to watch all of it. Recommend a couple episodes. Yeah. And I said, watch the fried ones. I think that was my exact answer. Don't you all start?
So, yeah, I mean,
I have so many thoughts about it.
I mean, I was absolutely fascinated by the way that this show really digs into food culture and like history and like how things get sort of passed on and sort of, you know, in a way, the discussion around kind of cultural appropriation in terms of food. So, like, I watched in the pizza episode. At one point, Chang, David Chang, right, says, something to the effect of, well, you know, the best pizza or his favorite pizza in the world might be this pizza that's made in this shop in, like, Tokyo, where it's, like, spicy tuna and, like, mayonnaise and stuff. But to me, it's like, thinking about that, I'm like, well, that is such a distinctly, wonderfully, like, Japanese interpretation of the pizza, or, like, complete kind of reinvention of the pizza. You know, that's not a pizza that's going to, like, in any way threaten or push out of any territory, like, traditional kind of Italian pizzas or anything. But then you have... in the episode on fried chicken, which, I mean, really gets into the whole, all the baggage that fried chicken is saddled with throughout American history and racism. But, you know, you have, like, these white restaurant proprietors who are doing, like, Southern fried chicken. And there's that question of, well, like, you know, what you're doing is not really, like, significantly different from what the black, you know, Southern fried chicken place up the street, you know, where they, like, pioneered the Nashville hot chicken or whatever, you know, what if you, like, put them out of business, you know? Like, what if you kind of destroy the thing that you're, like, riffing on? And so, I mean, and I don't have, like, answers to that necessarily, but I think it's such a fascinating discussion of, like, where it is, like, interpretation and, like, reimagination and, like, evolving things and trying new things based on, like, the inspiration of something, you know, exist, and where is something just kind of, like, inappropriate, you know, appropriation of another culture's, like, foods and traditions.
Yeah, it's not often that food shows like this get super political. And I always find that incredibly disappointing, because food is so political. It's so wrapped up with identity and culture and community and location. And, like, I didn't think, if you watch the series in order, There's a tiny bit of that at the beginning. Like, you know, they talk about undocumented workers in the tacos episode.
Yeah.
But it was like, it was the fried episodes, the fried chicken and fried rice, where they're like, this entire episode is about race and culture and appropriation and like who's represented, whose food is valuable, whose food is worthy of being high end. And I was like, damn, like that's when I was like, I fucking love this show.
Yeah.
One thing is about that episode, the fried chicken episode, there was a scene where they're with the white dudes who made the hot chicken. I think it was in Tennessee, because hot chicken's a Tennessee thing.
Yeah.
But and Dave is like, hey, what do you think about this? Like, what do you think about the fact that you're like, you could put these people out of business, or you're like white folks coming in and doing this like traditionally like complicated, it has so much race baggage tied up with it, right? That could be considered appropriation. And the guy answers some bullshit white dude answer, right? Yeah. Like, he doesn't know how to talk about this stuff. And I was like, oh, god damn it, right? When you think about documentary filmmaking, you think about, like, what is the message you're trying to say and who can say it and what does that look like? And I thought they were just going to leave it on that. But when they left that scene, Dave actually says, is it? Okay, hold on. It might not be that scene, but there was, I think he does it there, where outside he's like, yeah, this is a slow process. Like, he interjects his voice to be like, that wasn't a good answer. Mm. Like, that's not the answer here. And I really appreciated that they didn't just leave it hanging on this white dude being like, right, well, like, you know, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
Well, and don't forget that one of the inspiration, like one of the direct inspiration for the owners of Hattie B's, which I think is the restaurant that you're talking about,
is that they say,
like, we looked at what they were doing at Bolton's, which is a black-owned joint. Like, we looked at what they were doing at Bolton's. We tried to recreate their magic and kind of repackage it. And hopefully, he says, we're going to be good stewards of it. We're going to be good tenants of it. I think that's an amazing metaphor, right? Because, like, we want to be good tenants of this, right? But to be a tenant, what? The place has to be vacant. Like, the people who currently exist there have to be moved out. And so I thought it was very, like, I was gratified that after he says, you know, like, we want to make sure that we're being respectful, we're being good tenants of this stuff, that then the show goes back to Dolly at Bolton's, who says, listen, the reality is white people want to eat in a place where they see other white people, where, you know, they're sort of comfortable with the milieu. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. They're definitely going to keep doing what they're doing. And all we can do is the best we can do. But there's, in a way, there's kind of like, there's never going to be a bridge. We're never going to be able to reproduce the success they have, because they're catering to an audience that by and large has more money, that is less willing to, you know, cross the tracks to go see stuff. So, and like, she gave a very gracious answer, but I felt like it was very real too, where she was like, listen, the reality is, like, any white person in Nashville that wants to eat hot chicken, they're probably going to head to Hattie B's. They're not necessarily going to come to Bolton's.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Anita, because there's also the taco episode, which is, you know, amazing. And, like, there's one thing said at some point in the taco episode. One of the food critics or writers that they're writing with says something like, you know, the taco is, like, the perfect canvas for whatever kind of deliciousness, whatever flavors, you know, you want to, like, communicate or give to the eater, which I just thought was, like, a really interesting way of thinking about it. But in that, there's a whole thing about the restaurant, is it Noma, like, going to Mexico, right, and setting up a restaurant there.
Yeah, like,
and
a pop-up.
Yeah, and doing these, like, really, like, high-end, fine dining, like, tacos. And I mean, like, you've spent a little more time in the world of, like, really nice restaurants than I have. What, like, do you have feeling? I mean, because that, to me, it seems like, well, they're mostly, like, white people from Europe coming in and sort of carving out that space of the like, high-end.
Well, what I'll say about the Noma thing, and like, I completely agree with that. The one thing I'll say about that is that Rocio Sanchez, who worked at Noma, she started Gia de Sanchez in Copenhagen, which, when I was in Copenhagen and someone was like, go eat some tacos, I was like, in the land of white people, I live in San Francisco. Are you fucking kidding me? These tacos are unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a avocado ice popsicle that is, like, top three favorite desserts I've ever had in my life.
Wow.
So if you're ever in Copenhagen, you got to check that shit out.
Yeah.
And this isn't, like, high-end dining. This is, like, a taco stand. Like, it's affordable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Rosio was a part of the crew that, like, you know, like, it was very much, and in the episode, they very much highlighted that, like, this is her cultural background, even though, you know, like, her dad didn't want her to go back to Mexico, like, they left for a reason. And I think that there is a struggle with all of it. And I like, there's someone on the show that says, why can't you have, like, really high-end cuisine and also street food in the same universe, right? There is a place in Southern California called Taco Maria that is doing, like, fucking high-end tacos. Like, the shit is unbelievably amazing. For me, it's about, like, it sucks that there's so much exclusion, right? That, like, you have to be of a certain class or a certain privilege, or you have to save up every fucking penny you have to go eat at Noma because it's going to cost you $300-$400 for that meal, right? And then what you were asking about of, like, going into these indigenous communities, like, there's that scene where they're with mostly women in this community. It's Rosio and Peter Meehan.
Yeah.
Who's the food writer who's very present on this show. And they're, like, making food from scratch. And there's a monologue at the end where he talks about, like, it is unbelievable to sit here and, like, have everything from, like, within a couple of feet and made this incredible meal. And I started crying. Like, I was like, oh, my God, I want that. But also, like, I have issues with traveling to cultures that are, like, as an American going into a culture and being like, show me your ways, especially with, like, brown folks, right? Be like, I get to come and be an American tourist and, like, see your shit. And you unfortunately have built your economy around us doing that, and, like, I hate it, and I don't do it because I don't want to be that asshole. So I personally feel tension around that kind of stuff. I kind of derailed this because I have many thoughts around all of this, but, like, I think that's tough. And, you know, the other thing too is it's not just that it's super white, which high-end dining is super white mostly, but it's also super male. Like, the food culture, like, the show, like, the only time you see women in this show is either, for the most part, there's a couple of women experts in here, but you see the wives and the girlfriends in the episode about home cooking. And then in that same episode, they did, like, interviews of different women for, like, 2 seconds that were, like, restaurant owners about what they have in their fridge. For the most part, men are the ones who are sought out as experts. Men are the ones who are considered, like, the great chefs of the world, that whose opinions and experiences are the most valuable. And there's not a lot of space for women.
But also, very importantly, the culture of food tourism is assumed to be a primarily male activity, right? So there's this way in which it's we're supposed to kind of impute the spirit of, like, adventurousness, both in a larger sense, but also specifically as it relates to food. Like, hey, people who are willing to try anything, like snake tongue tacos or, you know, tripe banana soup or whatever, like, those tend to be dudes, right? Which is entirely false, but those are the people that we see. So yeah, I get that, you know, you have a very critical eye, Anita, and don't necessarily want to replicate, like, food colonialism, but please go get a food show just so we can start to hack away, because I really enjoyed this show, but at the same time I was like, I know exactly what I'm going to get. It's going to be like the kind of band of outsiders, badass Anthony Bourdain 2.0, right? You know, where, like, there's a degree of, like, insufferability in the guy's personality, and that's supposed to be part of the charm. And so I actually thought it was kind of a hilarious meta comment. Then in addition to David Chang, we get Aziz Ansari, we get Gustavo Arellano. I felt like it was a rogues gallery of, you know, problematic ass dudes in the show.
Yeah, for real. Just for the record, I would love to have a food show. So if anyone is listening that can make that happen, I am all for it. Okay.
That's your pitch?
I'm just saying, if any of our listeners are, like, you know, make media and want to hire me to do a fucking food show, I would oh my God, that would be like a dream come true. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting too was, I just want to bring up the fried fried rice episode, because I really valued that conversation around whose cuisine is considered valuable.
Yep.
Right. And this actually goes back to what I was rambling about earlier with tacos. It's like tacos don't just have to be street food. They can be really high end fancy food. And that's like, I think that that's cool. Like I love the idea of experimenting with food and mixing cultures and trying different things and just seeing what fucking works. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I think with the fried rice episode, they really get into how Asian cuisine is not considered high end. It's not considered like it's fucking Panda Express. It's like, oh, let's just order takeout, whatever. And they dive into that for the whole fucking hour. And I really, I think that helps reframe how we think about who is valuable, right? This isn't just about the food. It's also the culture that we're talking about, right?
Yeah. There's this story being passed around on the internet right now by like AJ Plus and stuff about how on, I think, a British cooking show, but like a Malaysian contestant cooked a Malaysian chicken dish, and the judges criticized it, and she was like voted off the show because the chicken wasn't crispy. But it's the dish is like, it's not supposed to be crispy. It was just these like ignorant white, judges thinking like only being familiar with like, oh, like fried chicken or chicken of a particular type. And like the idea of this chicken not supposed to be not intended to be crispy is like totally foreign to them. And,
that's fucked up.
Yeah.
So I don't know what you all think. I recommend the show if you're into food stuff and politics and culture. I think that the other thing is that it's so well directed, and it's so like, this is the kind of media that I watch and I'm like, I want to make this, right? Mm-hmm. Like whenever, like the last time I felt that way was when I watched Beyonce's Lemonade, where I'm like, I want to make things. Oh, like it was so good and I was not expecting that. Right. So like I was like, I want this. I think it's really well done. Each episode has its own distinct style to it. Right. It's not just the same routine every. It's not the same structure every episode. They really shake things up and, some things work better than others. But I thought it was.
Yeah,
I highly recommend it.
Definitely people check out this fried chicken thing, because, we haven't even gone into the fact that there's this really wonderful way in which like the foreign born chefs say like, yo, your perspective on fried chicken, we get it, but that's not the associations we had with it. And also, don't forget, like every culture has a fried bird, right? Like Americans didn't invent this shit. Everybody has been frying that yard bird and making it delicious. So let's not forget that. Also, like David Simon has some interesting things. I don't totally agree with everything he says, which is probably heresy, but whatever. But definitely the fried chicken and the fried rice episodes, like, get into them. There's some interesting shit being talked about there.
Yeah, David Simon talks about like he goes into what is appropriation, what is it like. It's not super in depth, but I actually recorded that little bit because I was like, oh, this is really interesting about like how do cultures mix, right? Like America is this very unique place in some ways, in terms of like if you look at a European country, there's like a European identity, right? Like you are Spanish or French or Swedish or whatever, where Americans are this fascinating environment of all of these different cultures who like this came up because I was talking to a friend about it who lives in Europe, and I was like, look, we struggle with this. We don't know how to deal with difference in this country. But it's also what makes this country so fucking awesome, right? In terms of all of the different cultures and different things that are happening or whatever. So when he started talking about appropriation, it's like, well, what is that line? Like, what is the sort of mixing and like shared experience and shared cultural exchanges versus like straight up appropriation for financial gain.
And it's so interesting too to think about the different contexts that food exists in different parts of the world. Like there's the black couple living in Tokyo who make like soul food, I think. And the black man says like, well, one of the reasons I love living in Japan is that here it's like, the food is to some extent divorced from or doesn't carry with it all it doesn't have all the associations that, Japanese people don't have in their minds all the associations that, in the United States.
Right. Fuck this racist bullshit. Who doesn't like fried chicken?
Oh, yeah.
I'm just saying, who doesn't love that shit? Fuck off.
Yeah.
You can kiss Ebony's ass.
Now, listen, I will give people reasons to kiss my ass. You can't assign people to kiss my ass. That's not how this
That's
works.
Fair. That's fair. Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that lets you message a licensed therapist from anywhere at any time. All you need is a computer with an internet connection and the Talkspace mobile app. Hey, Ebony, this sounds perfect for you.
It really does. I mean, part of my anxiety is I hate leaving the house. So if I can talk to someone without leaving my house, I'm in it to win it.
It sounds awesome. And like sometimes the commute to your therapist's office is so long, you have to take time off work, blah, blah, blah. So like just being able to text or call your therapist and have access all the time is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I live in LA. If I can stay off the mean streets, my life is immeasurably better.
Well, to match with a perfect therapist for a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com/freak and use the code FREQ to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show. That's FREQ and Talkspace.com/freak.
All right, let's move on to the next thing we want to talk about this week, which is a mobile game called Bury Me My Love. It is by a group in Europe called Arte or Art. They're they do like programming, like television and
yeah,
film
I think they're actually
think.
A television, like an art focused television network in parts of Europe.
So they do primarily programming for like French and German speakers, I believe, and they've been doing a bunch of mobile games, which we were able to check out at GDC.
Yeah.
Carolyn and I were. So Bury Me My Love takes place through text messaging, like through a multi-day text message conversation between a married Syrian couple named Noor and Majd. And Noor is trying to flee Damascus to get to Germany.
Yeah. So first of all, the title, Bury Me My Love, I was like, to me, that sounded kind of ominous. Like, oh God, is the game like going to go to where one of them, you know, where she ends up dead. So I looked it up online about the game, and it says in Arabic, bury me my love is an expression that means take care. Don't even think about dying before I do. You might say it to a loved one before going separate ways. So that's where the title comes from. Yeah. And so yeah, if you've ever played a game like Lifeline or that Mr. Robot game,
I want to shout out that game.
Yeah.
So Night School, who made Oxenfree, did Mr. Robot, and I think they did a really good job of doing a like text based phone game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like that. So just
and yeah, so you know, this is a game that takes place over, you know, hours and days. You know, the character Noor that you're texting with, you know, she gets busy, she gets caught up in this or that, and you might have to wait, you know, half an hour or a few hours to hear from her again. And just, you know, that format, I find that for a story like this that is grappling with like real world issues and real world experiences, the way that structure just sort of inherently weaves the narrative into the fabric of your own life over, you know, a period of at least like a few days or something, I find there to be something really effective about that, because it sort of helps communicate that, oh, yeah, for some people, like, this is, like, these issues are a reality, you know? I mean, to me, my life, I couldn't be more removed from them, but, like, these are things that people fucking deal with and worry about and like try to navigate.
It was such a quiet experience for me, because as y'all know, I don't know shit about games. I don't play a lot, so I never know what
you're
to
changing
expect
that, though.
I know, thank goodness. You are widening my horizons, but so I had no idea what to expect, right? And from the very beginning, where you're involved in these weighty decisions, I mean, you kind of know what the end game is. Like, you're trying to help Noor get safely to Germany. So when she says to you, "Do you think I've forgotten anything? What should I be packing?" It's a game, and yet it's not a game, right? You know, this is not like, oh, I want you to go collect coins and, you know, jump on mushroom heads or whatever, right? Like, you're suddenly thinking about a person's life. There's never a way in which this is purely two-dimensional. It's not just images on a screen or words on a screen. You're thinking you know, quite literally about what it takes to keep someone alive. And so I was on edge for the entire time this game was playing out. Spoiler alert, I only got to Sophia. And then my adventure ended and it was like, do you want to restart the journey and try and get into her father? And I was like, hell no, like I can't take it. You know, like I don't have the strength of will or heart to go through this again. I was so worried for her when, like, you know, messages would pop up about, you know, things that she was experiencing, worries that she was having and, you know, trying to guide her through. I couldn't take it. I had such a great time, but I hated it.
Yeah. And to its credit, the game is not all, it's not constantly like, its tone is not constantly, be tense, be really worried about this,
right.
Be on the edge of your seat. Like, there's moments of like, you know, heartwarming, like, reunions mm-hmm. with loved ones, potentially. Or like, you know, because Noor will send you photos from time to time, too. And so, you know, it really, like, humanizes her, and it humanizes this journey and like makes you really feel like, you know, this is not just a series of like decisions to arrive at one of, you know, four possible ending outcomes. Like, mm-hmm. oh, this is a person who, you know, has these lived experiences and these connections and these people mm-hmm. that she cares about and who care about her and everything. And, you know, it really does an effective job of making you, I think, invested in their relationship and in getting Noor to mm-hmm. to safety.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, am I wrong? I feel like when you start the game and you're given the option to choose what language you'll receive the messages in, it's, you know, like French, Spanish, Italian, German, English. I think those are it. But like Arabic wasn't one of the options, which I thought was interesting for this game. Right. But then also there's a weird disconnect because the messages are coming to your phone and you are placing yourself within the character of, is it Majid? I'm probably pronouncing that 87 incorrect ways. And so your words are his words in the game. But then there are times when his words are not things that I would say. Right. So, for instance, he says something like Noor comes up. She gets to a certain place and there's a bunch of African migrants there. And one of the things that Majid says is, you know, be careful around those thieving Africans. And Noor calls him up on it. But it was weird to have that come from a character, you know, that I ostensibly was playing. Right. That was supposedly me.
So I was thinking about that too in terms of the way that the game plays out. So you can occasionally choose out of one or two comments to say or three emojis, and those are the choices. And then the rest of the dialogue of your character just auto fills. And it is this thing where I was having tension between, I don't like any of these choices. I don't want to react with an emoji right now. I don't want to choose these two options that aren't very different. And then as the conversation was unfolding, I'm like, but I wouldn't be saying this stuff. So there's this tension of, okay, am I inhabiting the role of this guy, or am I playing the game how I would like to play the game,
right,
for example? And that really actually pulled me out of it in moments. I also found him fucking insufferable.
Yeah.
Like, he drove me batty because, like, he was just so patronizing to her, and, like, she would push back sometimes, but not other times. And then, like, there were moments where I know you're supposed to be, like, giving advice, but for the most part, I wanted to default to, you are there.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. I'm happy to offer some thoughts and stuff, mm-hmm. but, like, I want you to make the decision that makes you feel the safest, mm-hmm. not, like, no, don't do that. Or,
right.
You know, like, just aggressive shit like that. And then, like, him getting pissy about her buying food for Emmanuel, who was helping her, and, like, that they, like, seriously bonded.
I didn't get to that. See?
That shit pissed me off.
Maybe I wouldn't have lost him if I had bought him some food. I made bad decisions. Surprise!
Well, so, yeah, well, you know, sometimes there's no good decision, right? Like, that's the thing. And so, in my playthrough, I can't even say it because I feel like a monster. I ditched the pregnant woman in the forest and went with and caught up to Emmanuel. But I was trying to, But I didn't quite realize that it was like an either or choice at that moment. I was like, somehow I can make this work, but whatever, you lose them and that's it. So I got with him and he, and so like we got through wherever it was that we were going at that leg of the journey. And then it's like, okay, we're going to get food and then we're going to whatever, blah, blah, blah. So the Majd is like, are you spending your money on food for him? Or the other option was, you know how I feel about that. And I'm like, shut the fuck up, you asshole. You're not here. And why was he not? I don't understand. I don't remember why
Me
the story
either.
Was the way it was. Like, why is he there and she's
so
not? And
the reason for that is...
Man, thank God for Carol who does the research.
I know.
She puts in the work.
No, I looked it up before. I didn't. It's something like Majd is still taking care of his parents.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I remember she says, yeah, like, you know, there, he still has family at home, so he couldn't just leave. Yo, like,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm such an idiot, I was trying to outthink the game at all points, right? And because I didn't know what the title signified, there was a part of me that was always on edge, waiting to receive a message, like, you know, things are so bad, I've been hit, whatever. And then the line, bury me, my love, right? Like, I expected that to come. I thought, like, the game was necessarily going to end with Nora's death, and I just did not ever want to get to that point. And because I couldn't figure out like why Majd wasn't with her, I was like, is this going to be some weird thing where like he's already dead, she's not actually having this conversation, this is all in her mind? I just,
oh Jesus, Ebony.
I only thought that for a little while. I'm just telling you, I'm the dumbest video game player ever, so don't
no,
ever don't leave me alone.
There were
to
some
do this
touches
stuff.
There were some touches that I thought were thoughtful, like you know, when she gets detained in Cairo, well, okay, on my playthrough, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She gets detained in Cairo and this like English white woman is like, let me use Twitter to like cause a stir to get us out of detention. And the like the conversation of being like, fucking privilege, man. Right.
Yeah.
Like, I appreciated that. And then there's another moment where she's by herself hitchhiking and like all is going well. And then you find out like a day later or 2 days later or something that like she got out of that truck because the guy was like touching her thigh. And so like I appreciate that there are these like gendered race elements to it that are very clearly included, which would be a part of the story. The whole time I'm like, yeah, you are a single woman traveling mm-hmm. through God knows where with like you are doing everything to save your life and putting yourself into all of these situations that could be really super dangerous. So when she's like, yeah, he touched my thigh, and the response was, what do you mean? What does that
yeah.
mean? And you're like, what do you mean? What does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, are you fucking serious right now? It was shit like that I kept like rolling
yeah.
my eyes at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I sort of just at a certain point just bought into like, okay, I'm playing a character who I do not define, and that character is a real obnoxious jerk. And, I mean, I wasn't happy about it, but I just trying to rationalize it as, okay, like, this character is, like, written as an
yeah.
asshole.
Well, and, like, so part of me was like, oh, how long have they been married? Are they just, like... do they just like banter like a married couple? And then like
sure.
they didn't, there wasn't as much affection as I would have expected.
Yeah.
Like there was one point where you got to choose to say I love you or see you. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, why aren't you saying I love you so much more?
Okay.
This,
I didn't have
like,
your experience of this game sounds entirely different. Like in terms of the responses huh. and the choices, we should talk about this offline because I feel like although we had similar ending effects, or impressions, a lot of the stuff you're talking about, I'm like, I didn't get to do that. That didn't happen
yeah.
to me.
I don't actually know the end of my story. So the way so I got to Germany.
Oh,
congratulations.
And then, well, but then I got detained.
Oh, right.
So like you get to the bus station in Germany and then like the cops take you somewhere. And then there's an audio clip that plays, and that's like the end of the story. My audio clip won't play. Like, I don't know what it says, so I don't actually know what happened to her.
Wow.
Yeah, you may have to go on like YouTube and search for like Bury Me My Love endings.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, it'll be like the movie Clue, where there were the three theatrical endings.
If
you get the DVD, you can watch all three.
Yeah, it'll be exactly like that.
Shut up, youngster.
I know the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your parents told you about it.
I've only watched half of it.
Moving on.
Shall we move on to the freakouts?
Yeah.
All right. Who wants to go first?
I always go first. Ebony, you go first this time.
I will go first, and I think y'all will be pleasantly surprised because I actually wrote down my notes. I'll still just be winging it, but maybe it won't be quite so painful to listen to.
Unacceptable. Unacceptable.
Listen, Ebony. I'm not going to be your clown every episode, Anita. So my freakout this week is a show on Netflix called Requiem. And it is a...
Oh, I heard about this.
Yeah, so it's like, it's this 6-episode supernatural horror thriller kind of mind fuck of a show. I binged it all in one day. I was intending to watch just an episode or two and talk about it, and then wound up watching all 6 episodes. So y'all know my jam is things that hew very closely to the generic conventions of which they are part, right? So the more cliched something is, the better for me. If it's a crime show, I want it to be just a real straight up, like, hackneyed crime show. If it's, you know, a Western, I want it to be just like in your face, the most Western-y Western. So this series and the way it deploys like the most classic kind of horror genre touchstones, cliches and tropes, very well done. Like, just it kept me involved. So I really enjoyed watching it, and I heartily recommend it. There are some incredibly interesting things going on in this about trauma. So the story is, there's this young woman who finds out that her mother potentially was involved, she's not sure to what extent, with the disappearance of a young Welsh girl a couple of decades prior. And so over the course of this show, she has to try and figure out her mother's involvement, what this means for her. You know, she's surrounded by mystery and obfuscation at every turn. So the things that I loved about it is the way that it sets itself up using the kind of contours of like folktale and fairy tales. So the tropes of like the lost mother or the false mother, the absent mother, you know, I just found it really interesting the way that it played with those things. I like the way it reckoned with the kind of looming notion of the family, which is something that the horror genre is absolutely obsessed with. Community, contamination, you know, like, I just really got into it. I love the way that this show, I'm trying not to spoil things, but the way that it demonstrates in a very like visceral, in-your-face way, the way that grief makes you selfish and blind and self-focused and irrational in a way. So yeah, I recommend it. I specifically recommend episode 4. Again, I'm trying not to spoil things, but just know, completely out of context, the notion of a DNA test doesn't come up till episode 4. It's going to drive y'all bonkers, the fact that no one mentions the term DNA test till episode 4. But also, there's this really cool kind of allusion to the Dr. Seuss episode Blink, or, you know, like a scene that plays out like that, that I loved.
What?
Right. And then, nice. Okay, so if people watch this show, get at me, because I need to talk about what happens in episode 5 and the way in which, like, the main character does something that is, to me, so beyond the pale. So get at me, at Ebony Aster. I'll set up a private channel with, you know, 2 turntables and a microphone, and we can talk about this shit. Once y'all watch it, please get at me. Requiem. It's on Netflix.
All right.
Sweet. Carol, what's your freak out?
So I almost went with this last week, this freak out, and then I switched to whatever my freak out was last week. But like, it was interesting, Ebony, because last week you talked about that movie Prom Night, mm-hmm. and like how malls as a part of American space and American culture are kind of we're losing them, right? There's a video on YouTube that's got like over 1 million views, and it caused something of a sensation. And it's what the video is it's the song Africa by the band Toto, oh, but it's remixed to sound like it's playing in an empty mall. And And for a lot of people, myself included, there's something that's very difficult to describe about the emotional effect of hearing a song like that remixed in that particular way, because it does, I remember in my youth times when I would walk through malls when they were basically closed or almost empty, and there's just a feeling of like being in this space that you normally experience as really crowded and bustling and everything, but now it's like empty. It's like a ghost town, but there's still like this kind of reverberating ghostly kind of music playing. And like YouTube creators, a bunch of them have done a whole, you know, numerous variations with different songs and everything, but there's just something to me quintessentially like mall rock about Toto's Africa that is just like the perfect song for this. In the New Yorker, Gia Tolentino wrote a piece called The Overwhelming Emotion of Hearing Toto's Africa Remixed to Sound Like It's Playing in an Empty Mall. And I just want to read the last part of it because I think it gets at why, for me and for other folks, there's something so kind of powerful about this particular video. She writes, "Our lives increasingly play out in virtual spaces. Instead of going to malls, we surf on Amazon. Many of us would happily forego the mess of a party to stay home and flirt through an app. Listening to music, too, is now mostly frictionless. And this quality is why the little shadow world of music that that these YouTube creators inhabit is so appealing to me. It's nice to think of a handful of young people playing around on Ableton on their laptops, in their bedrooms, trying to reintroduce a sense of physical space into a listening environment of digital isolation. Conjuring the sort of scenario in which, say, you're down the hall from your older sibling who loves the Beach Boys, or in a place where, for a change, someone else controls the music, in a crowd or at a mall or in a pounding bathroom, someplace where you've taken the chance of being lonely in public instead of retreating and clicking around alone." So there's a whole series, like there's videos, like there's songs remixed to sound like you're in a bathroom at a party and the song is playing like outside the bathroom, or like you're driving home through the rain and this song is playing on your radio, like all these kind of specific experiences that carry with them a very specific emotional texture, and like there's one of a Rush song that sounds like it's playing from another room, and that I mean, like in my dorm in college, like there was so many people listening to Rush, and I would hear it through their rooms.
And yet, you didn't drop out.
I know, I endured. You know, so hearing that, it's like it's a very powerful, like, oh yeah, I'm back in that dorm. So anyway, that the Toto Africa playing in the mall one is the cream of the crop, but really fascinating.
So when Carolyn showed me this, I didn't take it. Like, you just made this sound so amazing and special in this, like, time and place and experience, which is great, and I love that.
Yeah.
But when you showed me this in the office last week, what did I show you in response?
Oh, my God. It was amazing. No.
It's so good.
Anita showed me the song A Whole New World from Aladdin, the whole animation, mm-hmm. you know, everything, but with realistic audio. So, you know, it's
so
just
good.
Like, it's basically because they're flying through the air so fast.
The whole thing is...
It just sounds like almost like jet engines, you know, like you see Aladdin singing, but there's no way Jasmine could possibly hear him.
And you can't hear it, and so When they dip out of the sky back into the village, you can hear the sound, like the song again. And then as soon as they go back up into the sky, it's just...
it's very funny.
It's so fucking good.
It's so good.
Oh, man.
Sorry, not to ruin your
No,
moment.
I mean, that's...
I'm really big on just sitting and watching stupid YouTube videos, so...
Yeah.
I'm happy for YouTube video recommendations. All right, my freakout this week is an album by Bishop Nehru, who's a 21-year-old kid that's just fucking killing it.
Wow.
He released his first solo debut this March, called Elevators, Act 1 and Act 2. It's a hip-hop album. The first act is called Ascension, and it's developed with K-Tronada. And then the second act is called Free Falling, and it's developed with MF Doom. So I didn't really know much about this guy. But apparently, like, he was sort of this, like, super young kind of rising star and was working with MF Doom. And then, like, projects didn't happen and he got signed to labels and then left them and all this stuff. So, like, it's kind of a big thing that this album came out. And I remember when I was listening to the second act, I was like, man, this feels really old school hip hop in a way that's really resonating with me. And I was reading a review from Pitchfork about the album, and the reviewer was talking about how some of the beats from MF Doom in the track are... or in that part of the album are kind of old or recycled from other places. And I was like, oh, that's that's why they seem familiar and like warm and fuzzy. And I think I don't have a problem with that. I think that there's value in sort of taking and remixing and mashing things together. I will also just say, I've said this before, I am really bad at listening to lyrics. So just in advance, if the lyrics are fucked up, I don't know. I just think it's I really like the music on it. So check it out. Bishop Nehru, Elevators, Act 1 and 2. Out now. Cool. So that's our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. We cannot make this podcast happen without our generous backers on Drip. Drip is Kickstarter's brand new subscription-based crowdfunding platform. Help us keep bringing this podcast to you every week by joining the FemFreak community. We've got some great rewards for you, so pitch in now at d.rip/FemFreak. If you are enjoying the show, we have a small favor to ask. Please leave us a review on iTunes because it really helps us spread the word about our show. And you know, while you're sitting around eating the foods, especially the tacos, tell your friends, hey, Feminist Frequency Radio is this cool new podcast you should check out. You can find all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all the news. And we want to hear from you, so... Carol, where are you at on Twitter?
I am at Carolyn Michelle.
Ebony?
I am at Easter Funny.
And I'm at Anita Sarkeesian. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. We'll see you next week.